Partly sunny and cold for today, a high of 33. Normal high this time of year would be 44. Tonight, sunset will be at 424. Cloudy and windy. Tonight's low 28 with winds up to 20 miles per hour. And then on Wednesday, partly sunny and 33. And looking ahead a little farther, Thursday, Thanksgiving, partly sunny and 37. Friday, sunny for the morning, cloudy for the afternoon, 46 on Friday. And then Saturday and Sunday, 50-50 chance of rain both days, but temperatures in the mid to upper 40s. Right now, wind from the northwest at 8, 28 degrees and holding in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com.
There are not many single words that can strike a very deep emotional chord in the hearts of most Americans, but one such word is Antietam. Similar to Gettysburg, Antietam was an especially bloody moment in our nation's history and especially bloody conflict in our Civil War. And as a matter of fact, it was in many respects the most savage and brutal and consequential of all battles, and in some respects, at least, the most lethal day in American history. The Battle of Antietam has been covered extensively. A number of books have been written about it, and yet I am so glad that there was yet another written, because the most recent book about Antietam is an extraordinary accomplishment of its award-winning author, Justin Martin. The book is titled A Fierce Glory, Antietam, the Desperate Battle That Saved Lincoln and Doomed Slavery. Justin Martin is well-traveled in such matters, the author of 5 previous books about historical matters, and 2 of his most recent titles about the Civil War, Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians, and other works as well. This book is published by Da Capo Press, and I remember fondly a conversation with Justin Martin about his book Genius of Place, The Life of Frederick Law Olmsted. Olmsted, the designer of all kinds of important parklands all across the country, a much more idyllic topic than what we cover today. Again, this book is called A Fierce Glory. And Justin Martin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
So let's talk, first of all, about this matter of Antietam having been written about so extensively over the years. So for you as a historian wanting to bring something new, something enlightening to such well-traveled territory, how does a historian go about doing that, looking for, in a sense, something fresh and interesting to say?
Well, I'd say Antietam is kind of an ideal case because it is so well documented. I mean, 100,000 people participate in the battle, and I'd say probably 3 or 4% of them, I'm talking 3 or 4,000 people left behind some kind of account. So anybody who's interested in Antietam is guaranteed to find stuff and to find fresh stuff, because nobody can really cover something that's that well documented. And so in my case, what kind of led me to the battle and made me want to kind of revisit a battle which, as you said, has been covered in previous books is, you know, the most recent, what you might call serious book about Antietam is from the last century. It's from the 1980s. And so I wanted to attend to the battle in a sort of a modern fashion. I wanted to bring to light certain topics that really have been kind of overlooked. And one of the main ones, which I'll sort of highlight here, is this was a battle that obviously took place on a battlefield, and yet there were extra battle activities that were so essential. And in old accounts, you know, they tend to be battlefield accounts describing the battle action. But Lincoln standing by, preparing to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, seemed to me something that should be right in there, woven right into the narrative, since that's and likewise, the fact that Robert E. Lee was a cruel slaveholder seemed like something that, again, in a traditional military account, the writer tends to be kind of agnostic. They can attend to Lee's true ability as a just master tactician on the battlefield and kind of conveniently overlook or ignore his views on the issue of slavery. So as I said, I wanted to do a sort of a more modern account in which Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation designed to end slavery, Lee's view on slavery, were kind of in collision. And so I wanted to attend to some of what you might call this extra battlefield activity and kind of weave it through the narrative and do a sort of a modern style account.
Right. And you do a remarkable job, and I do so appreciate that. And it's one of the things that makes your book very distinctive and certainly very valuable. I want to return to something you said at the top of your answer. You mentioned that, and I'll say again, that more than 100,000 soldiers were present at Antietam. And you tell us that many of them wrote about it, which resulted in what you call an embarrassment of research riches.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to know in what form that writing took shape. I'm assuming we're talking about kind of a crazy quilt of letters and journals, and perhaps even some of them took the time to write books. I mean, just what kind of an array are we talking about in terms of how participants in the Battle of Antietam wrote about it? And typically, when were they writing about it? I mean, what kind of span of time are we talking about in terms of this particular written legacy?
Well, crazy quilt, the term you use, is an apt description, and it is everything from diary entries to letters to articles that people would write after the battle, to officers' reports, which the officers, the ranking officers in both armies were required to issue reports after the battle, various published accounts, speeches people gave in some cases that have been preserved that they might have given to a local organization in honor of the regiment they fought in, that might even be preserved. And these ranged from when they appeared to everything from those crucial contemporaneous accounts, which are really important in a Civil War battle. I mean, you don't want to rely for certain details on the 30 or 40 year old memories of someone. So those letters where they wrote home to their mom, dad was just involved in a ferocious battle, and they described the action. Those have an authenticity or a reliability that might be lacking in some of the late accounts that were written many years after. Likewise, diary entries have a lot of value in that regard, and the officers' reports have a lot of value from the standpoint that they were done soon after the battle, and the officers were called upon to really account for what happened. But one of the things I was really struck by is for so many people, whether it be an officer or a foot soldier, Antietam was the most ferocious activity they were ever involved in. It was also the most consequential activity for many of the participants. And although many people, their day at Antietam might consist of 20 minutes of fighting, a lot of the soldiers, it stuck with them for the entire rest of their lives. And so if you can find certain figures who just wrote, wrote letters or kept accounts or what have you, going for years after the battle, they would continue to correspond with the members of their own regiment. In some cases, I found it very interesting, as the tensions started to die out after the Civil War, some of the most inquisitive writers would then actually connect with their former former enemies. And they would say, you know, a Union soldier would write to someone who had been a rebel soldier that day and say, I understand, you know, it's my recollection that our regiment, you know, faced your regiment, you know, in this, you know, in the bloody cornfield. What are your recollections of that day? And I even came across really fascinating accounts of soldiers going to the battlefield and Union and Confederate soldiers walking the field together and discussing, you know, what had happened on that long ago day. I thought, boy, I wish, I'm glad that they left accounts. I thought, boy, I wish I'd been with them walking the field. I'm sure it'd be interesting to be with you know, formal blood rivals as they walk the field.
Absolutely. In fact, your author's note includes a few words about one of the participants at Antietam, John Meade Gould. And you do mention, among other things, that decades later, he began not only corresponding with other Union soldiers, but even with some Confederate soldiers who had been at Antietam. And you quote him as saying, Confederates are the better correspondents.
That's right. No, he was. If we are privileged as a society to have John Gould, among others, having left such a fine correspondence, which is available, but I should mention, at the New York Public Library, for anybody who is interested, it's all there to be looked upon. And you know, he was a bank clerk from Portland, Oregon, fought with a Maine regiment. Before the war, he was a bank clerk in Portland, Oregon, and after the war, for his entire career, he was a bank clerk in Portland, Oregon, getting only a single promotion. So, you know, in grand historical terms, you know, he wasn't someone who was a big historical figure, and yet this battle, this grand historical battle, loomed so large for him that he spent the entire rest of his life writing about it, writing his recollections, corresponding with members of his regiment and Confederates, as you pointed out, and really creating a very, very valuable resource that's available to the world.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Justin Martin about his newest book, which is called A Fierce Glory, Antietam, The Desperate Battle That Saved Lincoln and Doomed Slavery. It is probably important for us to understand the state of affairs, generally speaking at least, when the Battle of Antietam was waged. This is in the fall of 1862. At this point in time, describe for us the respective fortunes of the Union and the Confederacy as far as this war was concerned.
Well, I'll take the Confederacy first. They were on a winning streak, feeling very emboldened to the point, in fact, that Antietam, which took place in western Maryland, represents the first ever Confederate invasion of the North. There'll be another invasion about a year later, very well remembered, when the Confederates invaded Pennsylvania and fought at Gettysburg. But this was the first invasion. As I said, Robert E. Lee, the Confederate commander, and his army were feeling very emboldened, and they had almost a diabolically clever scheme for what could happen in the favor of the Confederacy if they were to win a battle on Union soil. Obviously, they demoralized the Union. They also anticipated that they might be able to interfere with the Union midterms, which were just a couple months away. That was one of Robert E. Lee's ideas. He was a very careful student of the Yankee press. And he saw that Lincoln's political fortunes were kind of on the wane. He perceived that a victory on Union soil would cause the Republican Congress to possibly be replaced by a Democrat Congress. And that Democrat Congress, in turn, they might be less committed to the war. They might be willing to hobble Lincoln's war effort. They might even be willing to reach out to the South and invite the South back into the Confederacy, you know, negotiate an end to the war, maybe invite the South back in with slavery intact. So there was an idea that a victory could tilt the midterms. There was also an idea that the great European powers, England and France, were standing by. They made it perfectly clear that one more Union loss, and they were going to step in and you know, sort of try to negotiate a division between the between what were now two warring countries. They also had a perception that that perhaps they could tilt the state of Maryland into the Confederacy, although Maryland had stayed in the Union. It was what was called a border state. Sentiment in Maryland was very mixed. There was much sympathy for the South. There were slaveholders in Maryland. So they'd stayed in the Union with the institution of slavery intact. A victory on Maryland soil might tilt Maryland into the Confederacy. Other kind of wavering, what are called border states that maintained slavery yet stayed in the Union were Missouri and Kentucky. They might also follow Maryland, and all of a sudden the Confederacy would be enlarged, and with it, its prospects of winning. And finally, you win on Union soil. You don't leave Union soil, at least not immediately. And so there was the possibility that a victory at Antietam in western Maryland, they could, you know, the rebel army could maraud through the north, menacing Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., and who knows where else. However, the thing that's kind of fascinating is Old Abe was no slouch, and so if the Union was to win, and I should mention, too, the Union was in the midst of a terrible losing streak at this point, but if the Union could possibly eke out a victory in western Maryland, Lincoln had his Emancipation Proclamation tucked into his desk at the White House. He'd shared it with only a handful of his cabinet members and close advisors, but he was prepared in the instance of a Union victory. He couldn't issue the Emancipation Proclamation on the heels of a loss. It would look kind of desperate. But a victory, he would issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which the same way I described that all of these things could redound to the South's advantage if the South won, if the North won, and then Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, it would serve as a beacon to slaves throughout the South, get them to flee northward. It would get them to abandon their contributions to the Southern war effort, where they were obviously the slaves weren't fighting in the Southern Army, but they were in the Confederate Army, but they were growing food that fed the Army. They were making weapons and munitions that armed the Army. So the Emancipation Proclamation had the capacity to sort of, if the Union won, Lincoln issued it, it could cause all these advantages to flow to the North. So it was really it was shaping up to be a really consequential battle with huge stakes on either side and huge consequences for whatever side won.
Right. In your words, Antietam was a desperate contest. That's why the death toll was so high. Yes. There was it was a matter of life and death as far as both North and South we're concerned. One interesting thing to consider is, for instance, the high hopes that someone like Robert E. Lee and other Confederate officials had about what this could mean if the South had won this battle at Antietam, mm-hmm. in terms of really tipping the war in another direction from which it perhaps could not have been returned. Do you think those hopes were well-founded, that a victory by the Confederates at Antietam might indeed have brought about what they imagined it could?
I think it's kind of like the old, I believe it was, I'm thinking of it right now, but I believe it was an Isaac Asimov story where someone stepped on a butterfly in the past and it affected the present. I think at Antietam... People may remember that story, and I may have Asimov wrong. It might have been another science fiction writer. But had Antietam been won by the Confederates instead of by the Union, we would be feeling the consequences today. Up to and including, we might simply be living in two separate countries, a country that was the Confederate States of America, whatever they chose to call themselves, and the Union States. And that barely might have been the consequence had the South won at Antietam, because all of those various ramifications which I mentioned were, you know, they were not settled. They would have happened. For instance, the Union really probably would have seen the Democrats sweep in the midterm. That might have ended the war. On the very day of Antietam, amazingly, there was a letter from a French minister to a British minister that said, if there's one more, now of course, no CNN in this era, so they had no idea, the English and French, that is, that an actual battle was being, a consequential big battle was being fought in Maryland. But a letter went out that very day, September 17, 1862, which said something to the effect of, one more loss, and shouldn't we step in? And you know, sort of, it was in much more formal diplomatic language, and I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of, you know, one more loss, and shouldn't we step in and try to separate these warring nations? So there are a lot of things that really, you know, nothing was settled a year and a half into the Civil War, and had this very early but important battle gone a different way, I think it would have rippled forward to the present.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I appreciate about your description of this battle is that you, in really remarkable detail, describe the landscape in which this battle was ultimately fought. And you do so in a way that reminds us that what we now think of really only as a battlefield wasn't always a battlefield. That once upon a time it was a place where people lived peacefully and worked and farmed and played and so on. And then it becomes something else. And in the case of an Antietam or a Gettysburg, it becomes inexorably linked with the carnage there for the rest of time. Describe to our listeners this really idyllic setting in which this battle ultimately took place, and also some of the aspects of it that in a sense contributed to how the actual battle ultimately unfolded.
Sure. What's now, as you said, Antietam National Battlefield, a kind of hallowed site, 3,000 acres that you know it's sort of a park set aside to kind of for people to visit and remember this big event. September 17th, 1862, this was simply really, really rich Maryland farm country. Now, the farmers had had advance warning. They'd been fighting in the passes on something called South Mountain in the days leading up to the battle, kind of, sort of preparatory fighting. And so they knew that, and of course, these big armies came in and came into position. So people knew that this battle was going to happen. And many of the farmers and also many of the townsfolk from the town of Sharpsburg, which was right, right the nearest town to where the battle was fought, they'd taken cover. They'd gone and visited friends and relatives, a few miles one direction or another and found a place to wait out the battle. But the battlefield itself was then fought in, as I said, this really rich farm country, and every single one of the things that just fascinated me was how incredibly small decisions about farming, also features of the landscape, came into just incredible play for the battle. I'll give just two examples there. One is there was an unharvested 40-acre cornfield that belonged to a farmer named David Miller. The fact that he hadn't cut his corn down yet in September, that his fields weren't yet in stubble, resulted in this 40-acre stretch in which the corn, as some of the soldiers described it, was higher than a man. And so soldiers had to go through this cornfield, sort of terrified, not knowing what awaited them on the other side. They get to the other side, they'd be attacked by, if they were Confederates, they'd be attacked by Union soldiers and vice versa. So you had this incredibly ferocious fighting back and forth through this cornfield that was really driven by the fact that the cornfield hadn't been harvested, so people couldn't see what awaited them on the other side. Another example of a feature that just loomed large during the actual battle was there was a sunken farm road, just a modest farm country lane, that due to wagon wheels and wind and rain erosion was sunken some places more than 4 feet beneath the surface. And the Confederates got a couple thousand soldiers kind of hunkered down in this sunken road. They piled broken fencing and rocks in front of it and created a really formidable redoubt. And a big part of the action at Antietam was just wave after wave of Union soldiers trying to dislodge the Confederates from this sunken farm road, what ultimately would become to be known to history as the Bloody Lane. So these were, as I said, just an unharvested cornfield, a sunken country lane. They just loomed large in the actual battle.
Interesting. And you tell us the presence of good roads necessary in peacetime to transport the region's agricultural bounty to market was one of the reasons that in wartime two armies had converged in the area. I mean, I think most of us do not stop to think about why great battles occur where they are. And most of the time, it seems as though great battles occur where they do very much for strategic reasons, and we don't always think about the very sort of accidental reasons, the sort of peacetime reasons that that sometimes warfare and especially bloody conflicts are in a sense drawn to a particular location.
No, very true. And in the case of the Civil War, it was huge movements of men, hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of men they needed to be transported. That meant there had to be at least some kind of useful road. And ultimately, I kind of conceive it kind of almost like a chess game. You know, the Confederates had gotten into Union territory, into the North, into Maryland. The Union was pursuing them, and ultimately, the Confederates chose to make a stand in this valley, amid this farm territory, in this farm country, with the Potomac River to their back, and you might think of it almost like an exit ramp. So the Confederates decided finally, after this kind of maneuvering and, as I said, moving along these existing roads, the Confederates finally decided to make a stand near the town of Sharpsburg in this farm country with about a mile and a half to their rear. The Potomac River crossing available. So if they started to get beaten by the Union soldiers, their thought was, well, we'll flee across the Potomac River out of Maryland and into the safety of what was then, now West Virginia, but was then Virginia. So it was a little bit like a chess match, and ultimately, you know, the two sides, after sort of maneuvering, they found themselves in a place where both, you know, the Union felt like they could finally attack these Confederate marauders. The Confederates felt like they could also fight back, perhaps score a victory, but if in the off chance that they lost, they had an exit plan, as it were.
Hmm. I also appreciate the fact that you spend some time to talk about the civilians of this area, and in particular some of the civilians in the nearby town of Sharpsburg. I think often books are written about great battles, and scarcely a mention is made of civilians. And where were the civilians, and were they caught in the crossfire, or do they flee? You tell us that the vast majority of civilians living in this area had already left by the time the battle began. Am I remembering that correctly?
That is correct. That is correct.
You also... go ahead.
I was just going to say the vast majority had fled, but some chose to stay for whatever reason, and you know, they had to wait out the battle. And a good example is the Kretzer family. They just had a big and an ample basement for their home in Sharpsburg, and so they had many people, probably dozens of people, who'd taken shelter, who'd stayed, took shelter in their basement, and they just had they kind of waited out the battle. There were shells striking their house. The house was rocking from the reports of the cannon and so forth, so it was very terrifying to be down in that basement. It became doubly terrifying because the Kretzers were actually Union supporters, and at some point during the morning of the battle, five Confederates kind of slunk down into their basement, and at first they were terrified. They thought they were going to be attacked by these men, but these men simply wanted to get out of the battle the same as they did, and so... I thought it was a very, very interesting account that Teresa Kretzker, who was a girl at the time of the battle, left behind. Apparently the five Confederates, they just kind of went and huddled in a corner. They certainly wanted no part of this fight. They were glad to be at a basement to save the Kretzer family. But because they were Confederates and other people in the basement were Union sympathizers, they kind of took up a corner of the basement and kind of hung out there for the duration of the battle.
Remarkable. What a scene. That belongs in a film someday, and you describe it very well. I want to read another portion that comes just before the battle is about to begin. I want to read just this paragraph and then have you explain a little further. You write, "From a soldier's eye view, it would have been evident that the participants in this clash weren't merely men in blue versus men in gray. For this battle, as with others in the war, the uniforms had a distinctly individual, often local flavor. After all, soldiers served in companies that had originally formed in their communities. They mustered into service together, drilled together, and ultimately fought and died together. This reality was often reflected in their manner of dress." Can you give us at least a couple of examples of what you are talking about here? I find this fascinating.
I would be glad to. It's one of the things that really fascinated me in my research, and I really, you described earlier, a movie about the Civil War. I've seen plenty of Civil War movies, and I'm sure people have noticed. It just shows the blue versus the gray.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Had somebody been on that battlefield, for one who was on that battlefield that morning, they would have looked around and seen kind of a bewildering array of different uniforms. And it's had to do with this localism. And I'll give just a couple examples. You had what were called the Zouaves. And you had Zouaves were people who emulated this legendary Algerian desert fighting force. and they wore very kind of loud, flamboyant uniforms, billowing crimson trousers and fezes and so forth. Well, there was a unit fighting there that morning, which was the 9th New York, and they'd fashioned themselves out of Zouaves. The 9th New York was composed of people from the New York theater community, of all crazy things. So you had producers and actors and singers. And when they dressed up to go off to war, they didn't want to be in the standard issue of Union Blue. They being theater people, they wanted to have vibrant uniforms. So they took the field that day and comported themselves very well, I should mention, dressed in this kind of desert, flamboyant desert warfare uniforms, right down to fezes. You also had a Pennsylvania regiment known as the Bucktails, who every member of the regiment, these were country boys. They were used to hunting. And so every member of the regiment had a bucktail, as in the tail of a deer that they had shot that they'd pinned to their cap. So it was a minor variation in their case on the Union Blue, but you could certainly recognize a member of the Bucktail Regiment by the deer tails pinned to their caps. And then for the Confederates, so many of the Confederates, I mean, they faced privations in terms of you know, the availability of cloth, the availability of dye. So they simply did what they could. And in many cases, it involved taking captured Yankee uniforms, putting them in a bucket or a tub full of lye and acorns and other materials, boiling off the blue, and what would be left behind is a color that's often described as butternut. Butternut's kind of a tannish color, is what you get if you boil up a Yankee uniform, get the blue dye to be divorced from the cloth, and that's what's left behind. And I was very struck also with the Confederate soldiers that, you know, this was certainly early in the war, particularly this was they were fighting for regional sovereignty, and many of them they were going to have their own distinct uniforms. So although there was there were some Confederate uniforms issued, if someone could just throw together something that had some gray cloth or had some butternut cloth or whatever it might be, they would take the field, and sometimes in pretty idiosyncratic uniforms, wearing just a favorite as opposed to wearing a kepi cap, which people are probably familiar with, that both the Union and Confederates wore. They'd just be wearing a slouch hat or whatever. And so it was very, very individualistic dress on that day.
You write, shabby though they were, the rebels took fierce pride in their appearance. To be tattered and shoeless was, in its own strange way, a badge of individuality. Fitting, too, given that the Confederate cause was states' rights and resisting the demands of those outside their region. Anyone could don the standard-issue Union blue, went a common Southern sentiment, but it was a sign of genuine commitment to cobble together the uniform a rebel needed to take the field. You also go on a little later in this same chapter to talk about something that is hardly ever talked about, namely that not only was this not a simple matter of men in blue versus men in white. Let me start again. This is not just a matter of white men in blue versus white men in gray. It is not that simple at all, not just in terms of color of uniform, but also the fact that it was not all white men, and indeed it wasn't even all men who were fighting at Antietam. Tell us more.
That was one of the things I found very fascinating in my research, is there are a number of different, again, classic Civil War movie one might watch. It's going to be, as you said, men in blue versus men in gray, and they're going to be white men. However, the truth is, certainly there was a Connecticut regiment I came across an instance that had an Asian soldier. There were many, many Southern regiments, particularly from places like Florida, that had American Indians fighting in their ranks. There were Louisiana regiments that had Hispanic soldiers. And then you had a couple of Wisconsin regiments, which had African-American soldiers. And this was before African-Americans had been invited, per the Emancipation Proclamation, to join the Union forces. In their case, what they'd simply done is, for lack of a better term, they'd passed. They were light-skinned African-Americans who were able to pass as white and take the field with their fellow Wisconsin soldiers, but they were They were, from an ethnic standpoint, African Americans. As you mentioned, there are also, one of the things I found very remarkable was there are claims that there were as many as 8 women who actually took the field that day, kind of dressed in drag, wearing uniforms of either the Confederacy or the Union. And they had all kinds of different motives. There's an instance of a woman from Ellenboro, Wisconsin, who fought with a Wisconsin regiment. She was just a 16-year-old girl who she just wanted adventure. and she got it, presumably. There are other instances. As I said, the claim is that there's as many as 8 women, and in my research, I could certainly verify, I think, 4, that there's actually pretty good records of what they did, and at least that they were on the field that day. Another example is a woman who she had wanted to connect with her boyfriend, and when her boyfriend passed through Maryland, she simply donned a Confederate, or rather a Union uniform that she had been able, that her father for some reason had, and she joined the fight and actually got shot through the neck. She didn't die. She was fortunate enough to be treated by Clara Barton, who was present. So as a woman who'd been badly injured, I think it was probably, according to the accounts at least, it was very valuable to her to get the treatment, because she was believed to be a male soldier. When it was discovered that she's a female soldier, she was glad to have a female medical person nearby, in the case of Clara Barton, to treat her.
We're speaking with Justin Martin about his remarkable book called A Fierce Glory, Antietam, The Desperate Battle That Saved Lincoln and Doomed Slavery. As the battle begins, as we've already mentioned, you are careful to not only take us to the battlefield of Antietam, but also back and forth between Antietam and Washington, D.C., where President Abraham Lincoln is very anxious to receive word of what is ensuing there. You really do a remarkable job of describing who Lincoln was and the heavy mantle of responsibility that was weighing upon him, and also the fact that he was also still in the throes of terrible grief over the fairly recent death of his son. I so appreciate that you mention this, because this is also something that I think often is neglected when someone is writing about a huge battle. There's so much to write about, but we should not forget Abraham Lincoln, the human being, weighed down with terrible sorrows in addition to the terrible responsibilities of his office at this dark moment.
No, absolutely. And it was something that I was very struck by was Lincoln, he was in profound grief going back to February of 1862. And so, you know, for the past 6 months, going into the battle in Antietam, his grief over the death of his son, Willie, was profound. But Lincoln being Lincoln, he also took the grief that he felt and kind of transformed it also into a deep empathy that he felt for not only soldiers who were dying in the Civil War, but also the parents who were losing children. And in some ways, one can make a very strong case, I certainly made an effort to do this, that part of what drove the Emancipation Proclamation was Lincoln recognized that the Union needed to kind of up its commitment to the war. It was going to be necessary for the war to have a new, higher purpose, for the Union to really sort of turn up the volume and end this war, not let it just drag out and drag out. Part of what drove that feeling on Lincoln's part was a sense that he'd suffered a grievous loss. He appreciated that people around the Union, and for that matter, the Confederate, parents and the soldiers themselves, Lincoln appreciated that, and he thought that the Emancipation Proclamation, among other things, he felt that this would do the trick of sort of speeding up the war effort, and in a way, speed up the war effort, fewer soldiers are wounded or die, and fewer of family members are left in grief. So Lincoln's own grief over the loss of his son had a marked effect on his own conduct of the war. So you can really see an interplay between Lincoln, the president and father, and Lincoln, the citizen and father, and Lincoln, the president. You can really see those two things interacting at Antietam.
You describe an interesting triangle between three very important figures at this moment in history. President Abraham Lincoln, in a sense, his general, General John McClelland, and the Confederate general, Robert E. Lee. And it's very interesting to consider the dynamics of that triangle and the importance of each of them in terms of where the Civil War was at this point and where it was about to go from here. Let's talk for a moment. Go ahead.
Oh, if you're going to ask me about that triangle, yeah, it's very compelling. You've got Lincoln, who is a natural abolitionist, and also starting. He's a natural abolitionist, but as a lawyer president, he's also a pragmatist. He recognizes that he has a restive population, even in the Union states. He's going to have to, address or make concessions to public perception and public sentiment. But Lincoln, the natural abolitionist, is also seeing that there might be opportunity, particularly with the Union victory, to tie the war directly to ending slavery. So you've got him as one corner of that triangle. Then you've got his general, the commander of the Union Army, George McClellan, who is a Democrat. And in 1862 terms, a Democrat means one is on the conservative political party. It's almost like the political parties have flipped from modern times. So, and McClellan, although he's certainly keen to fight a war against the breakaway Confederacy, McClellan is really very much of the opinion that slavery is not an issue that compels him or that he really has any negative feelings towards. He simply wants to restore the Union. He's happy for the Confederacy to rejoin the Union with slavery intact. That would suit him just fine. And with that in mind, he's kind of a gingerly general, is how I often describe him. I mean, he isn't fired up with any kind of moral outrage. He just wants to win kind of strategic victories that will ultimately get the South to relent. And then he's happy for the South to rejoin the Union, as I said, the slavery intact. So Lincoln is forced to manage and work with a general who has a different attitude about a different perception about what the war is about, what its outcome should be. And of course, Lincoln and his general McClellan are fighting against Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general who history has often, as I said, been very agnostic about what his views on slavery are. He's been treated, as I earlier said, rightfully as a master tactician. But it shouldn't be forgotten that part of the reason Lee fought with the Confederacy is because he very much believed in the institution of slavery. He himself was a slaveholder, and he was a cruel slaveholder. One further point worth making that I certainly visit in my book is the issue of slavery didn't interest him in the least. In fact, you can go through his entire published writings, and he only makes a few references to slavery, which tells you something else. Not only was he a cruel slaveholder personally, but politically, he just thought slavery was part of the environment. It had always been there. It should always be there. He wasn't open to entertaining questions about it. He didn't think, maybe the people who are enslaved deserve, they're human and they deserve freedom. Those are not issues that even interested him or that he would entertain even in brief. So that's your triangle there. You've got those three men who had differing views having to confront one another and, in the case of Lincoln McClellan, having to work together during this battle.
You do a remarkable job of describing the battle itself, which unfortunately we have essentially no time to actually talk about in any detail in terms of what actually ensued, but I am so impressed that you're able to kind of pull together all of these various accounts about the battle and the chaos of battle and weave it together into an incredibly compelling narrative. You tell us at one point, maybe at the height of the battle, that soldiers were going down either wounded or killed at a rate of nearly one per second, 3,600 per hour. A pace that would fluctuate while remaining appallingly high throughout the day. And I appreciate not only those grim statistics, but also the fact that you take us onto the battlefield to those who were trying to tend to the injured, including the aforementioned Clara Barton. What a remarkable figure she is.
Indeed. Clara Barton, she had wanted to, her dream was to go right to the front lines, and she'd been to several previous Civil War battles, and she'd arrived late. In fact, she arrived 4 days late at Cedar Mountain. So Antietam, for the first time, she was able to be right there on the front line. So she didn't want to just be in the back attending to soldiers after the battle was over. She wanted to be helping them right in the thick of the action, and she was in the thick of the action, all right. In fact, there's one point at which she was giving, there was a soldier leaning against her, and she was tilting a canteen, giving him water, and all of a sudden she felt kind of a whoosh in her sleeve, and the very next instant the soldier fell back dead. He'd been shot through the heart, and she noticed there was a hole in her sleeve, and she decided never to mend that hole. And that would become part of her sort of uniform, as it were, in subsequent battles. That hole in her sleeve would serve as a reminder of the toll of warfare.
Mm. Part of the reason there is such a toll at Antietam is not only the huge number of soldiers, but also the fact that there had been new innovations in weaponry that created still more death and destruction than had once upon a time been possible. You tell us especially about what you call the most diabolical of all the projectiles used in this battle was something called case, invented by a Brit by the name of Henry Shrapnel. Can you say a word about this terrible instrument of death?
Sure. Shrapnel, as you said, was a British, a Brit who invented this. And a case, basically, per its name, it's an iron case that's surrounding a charge, a gunpowder charge, and when it would explode, so it would explode in flight, and the idea was that a skilled artillerist would see, you know, the enemy in the distance, try to time the explosion so that when the iron case surrounding the charge exploded, all of a sudden what would be traveling forward was not any longer a projectile, but just a bunch of twisted, sharp pieces of iron that would then just pelt this group of soldiers in the distance. And, you know, we've come in modern, I mean, it's a term people use now, and people are quite familiar with shrapnel, but it was a new innovation at the time of the battle and a terrifying one.
Hmm. You tell us that as this battle rages, that there are kind of mysterious shifts in momentum that are really very difficult to fully explain. And that's also very intriguing to follow through the course of your book. Ultimately, what spelled the difference in terms of the Union scoring a close and a very hard-fought victory at a terrible, terrible cost? What was the margin between victory and defeat, do you think?
The margin between victory and defeat was incredibly thin, and really the only thing that can be cited as the reason the Union won was I mentioned earlier that the Confederates had kind of set themselves up so they had an exit ramp, as how I describe it, or an exit route, I guess is a better word, back across the Potomac River into the safety of Virginia. Well, the night after the battle, or I should say two nights after the battle, Robert E. Lee took his bedraggled and hard-used Confederate army, crossed the Potomac back into Virginia, and this signaled the end of the Confederate invasion of the North, at least this first invasion. They'd be back for Gettysburg. And so from that standpoint, the fact that McClellan, the Union general, he'd been charged with protecting the Northern homeland, of driving the Confederates from Union soil, from that standpoint, he'd met his mandate. As far as how many casualties the Union Army took versus the Confederates, as far as any kind of claim to land being gained, territory being gained, it was pretty much a draw. And is also certainly the case could be made that had they reengaged in fighting, who knows what would have happened? Had they fought again, the following day after Antietam, which was a one-day battle, maybe the Confederates, score a surprise victory. So really, the only indicator of the only thing that could be cited as making it a Union victory is it did repel the Confederates, sent them back across the Potomac into Virginia.
Well, we leave it to our listeners to explore your remarkable book and all the detailed information that is there. And I want to also mention that on the cover of your marvelous book is a very striking photograph of Lincoln with two men on the battlefield of Antietam after the battle, of course, is all done. And it is a skillfully colorized photograph. And in a sense, that gives us a real, a remarkably vivid sense of the immediacy of this and the fact that the grass was green, the trees were green, and these were real human beings who fought the